Welcome to Ecology XP, a series by the Pika Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jillian Sokorowski-Legree, and I am here to talk to you about all things ecology and video games. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a PhD student who studies arachnids and ecology. If you don't know much about ecology, that's okay! If you'd like a more in-depth introduction, you can check out my interview with Dr. Ray in the Poke Science Podcast. But for time's sake, in short, ecology is about how organisms and their environments interact. One of my goals for the EXP podcast is to bring together scientists, gamers, and gamer scientists. So today, my gamer scientist guest is Brittany Hahn! Brittany, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So I am a curatorial assistant at the American Museum of Natural History, working in the invertebrate zoology department, specifically with entomology. And currently what I've been mainly doing is scanning and databasing odonates, which are dragonflies and damselflies, specifically for their wing morphology. So basically how they look in their size and shape.
Brittany and I have been internet friends for like, what, a year, 2 years? I don't remember when we first met or even how we met. I think I just saw there was another Korean on Twitter who liked bugs, so I followed you.
No, that's literally also what happened. I was like, oh, this person's a spider person, but she's Korean, so I'll follow her.
Well, we finally got to meet in person in January. I got to visit you at the American Museum of Natural History, where you work. And do you remember the gift I gave you when we got to meet?
Yes, I do. You gave me a little plushie of Rover from Animal Crossing, and he's still sitting like on my bedside.
Oh, amazing!
And so the Nintendo tote bag, you can't forget that.
The bag is super important. Yes, so that was my clue to you about today's topic. Uh-huh. So today's video game is Animal Crossing!
Yeah, let's go!
And I'm largely going to be focusing on Animal Crossing New Horizons, which is the most recent mainline Animal Crossing game. And more specifically, I wanted to bring you on to talk about museums, the role of museums, and the interactions that players have with the museum in Animal Crossing.
My hands just went to my mouth. I'm so excited for this.
I told you it was going to be good, and this is why I don't tell my guests what we're talking about, because I love these like pure reactions.
Yes. I can't wait to dive into this. Oh my gosh.
Brittany, how would you describe Animal Crossing to someone who has never played it before?
That's a good question. I would say it's a life simulator without all of the stresses of life, because there is currency, but it's not like a big deal for you to like pay taxes. Like the only thing you have to worry about is like your loans, which have no interest or like a due date, basically, unless you want to expand your house. And then you can just fish and collect bugs and dig up fossils whenever. It doesn't matter your geographic location for fossils. There's apparently just abundant sedimentary rock where you live, so that's great. And you can just chat with all of your villager friends, and it's awesome.
Animal Crossing was first released on April 14th, 2001 in Japan. And it was originally released on the Nintendo 64, which I did not know that. I always knew it was for the GameCube, but it was released, I believe, in the same year for GameCube in Japan, which I don't really understand that, but I'm glad we have it on multiple platforms. It came to the United States in 2002 on GameCube, so that's how I think most US-based people are familiar with it. And then it was released subsequently in other countries. The next game in the series was Animal Crossing Wild World for DS, and that released in the US in 2005. And this was my first Animal Crossing game. I don't know about you, Brittany. Do you have a first? Have you played many of the games in the series?
So I actually haven't. My first Animal Crossing game was New Leaf back when, I don't remember the exact year, but it was, I think, right after I graduated middle school. So that must have been like 2013 or 14.
Yeah. So in 2008, we got City Folk for the Wii, and then in 2013 is when New Leaf was released. And that brings us to the 2020 release of Animal Crossing New Horizons for Nintendo Switch. Do you have New Horizons?
I do. I played it for quite a bit when the pandemic hit, because it came out, I think March 20th, right? Which is like right, yes, after people still in university all like got sent home, basically.
Yeah, I I played it. I was a pandemic player too.
Yeah.
Well, the Nintendo website for Animal Crossing New Horizons gives this following description for the game. Nook Inc. invites you to create your personal island paradise on a deserted island brimming with possibility. Live life at your own pace as you garden, fish, decorate, hunt for bugs and fossils, get to know the animal residents, and more. The time of day matches real life, so something is happening on your island, whether you're there or not. So that's how Nintendo describes its own game. And what I think is really funny about the website is there, I had to like mash together some of the descriptions. There isn't just like one about page. And I think it's because there's multiple mainline games, but I think the assumption is that most people know what Animal Crossing is, which I think is really funny and probably true.
Yeah, you gotta be like in the know to be a really good experienced like Animal Crossing player. I don't know if you guys knew that. It's a very like advanced game for true gamers.
There's
you have to be an entomologist or a paleontologist or an ichthyologist in order to fully enjoy Animal Crossing.
Or Animal Crossing is like your gateway into becoming one of those three things.
Oh, 100%.
There's so much we could talk about when it comes to like Animal Crossing and ecology, because, you know, this podcast is about ecology. But like I said, I specifically wanted to talk with you today about Blathers and arguably Celeste's museum. And as you know, this is a podcast about ecology, but today's going to be a little different. And I think it's obvious that museums aren't a part of nature, but museums like the ones players see in Animal Crossing are invaluable for ecologists and science and education. And so it's not a traditional EXP episode where we're looking at a video game and, you know, drawing inferences about the ecology of a video game. I guess this is like a love letter to museums today and how important they are.
Yeah, for sure. I'm super excited to dive into it.
I'm also including scientific collections in this conversation. Scientific collections, as defined by the USDA, are collections of physical objects that have been gathered for research and other purposes and are set aside for long-term preservation because of their potential use and impact in the future. Museums are often the homes of the world's best scientific collections, and it's common to hear museum staff and researchers refer to, you know, the collections room. And Brittany, how would you describe collections and the role of collections in museums?
Oh God, where do I even start with this? It's just such a big, big and really great question. So I guess the first place to start with natural history collections in any science collection would basically be that they are a really important record of natural life across time and space. So the main goal of collections is to collect, so it's a continuous process even today, because we always think of museums as these like old places where they like hoard old stuff, right? We do have old things, but that's like super important because it's a record of biological life from across time and space. So we have lots of things that we collected at the same point regularly across time from a long time ago, and we're hopefully keeping up that collection to this very day so we can see how things like species ranges, morphology, so like color, shape, size of an organism have possibly changed over time. And this is, of course, a very pertinent conversation and the type of research to have these days because of climate change, so much anthropomorphic change, excuse me, happening across the world and shifting all of these things about organisms' life histories. So yes, museums and their collections are super important to have because they not only serve as a great educational resource for the public who visits them every day, but also for scientists, because there is active research going on in these collections that people might think are like super old. The point is that they're super old, but they're also still new. They're always changing, always growing. At least we hope so we can preserve these things into the future.
I also want to point out that collections aren't just in museums. Collections exist in many other formal institutions, such as universities, botanical gardens, insectariums, and zoos. So it's not just museums that house collections either. And so in this conversation, I'm including museums, museum collections, but also scientific collections that aren't housed solely within museums.
Yeah, that's super true. Especially given, I guess, recent events, I think university collections are really super important, and they really shouldn't get closed unless it's for super dire reasons. But anyway, yes, the collections that you see in like a university, even like small ones that you might see in a state school, give great opportunities for students to get like hands-on experience in collections, whether it's doing collections management or doing research with those specimens. Like, the reason I got my start in collections was because of the small collection we had at my university. So without that experience, I probably would not be where I am today.
I really love having you for this particular topic because I just think driving this message home of the importance of museums and collections is what I want people to get out of this episode. But to get to the Animal Crossing portion of all of this, in all mainline Animal Crossing games, players have the option to collect fish, bugs, and fossils and bring them to Blathers at the museum. There are a total of 80 fish, 40 sea creatures, 80 bugs, and 73 different fossils in New Horizons. And of course, like, taxonomically, I'm not going to comment on that to my fellow like scientists and researchers out there. Y'all know the struggle. But the character that runs the museum is Blathers. I actually wanted to find you a Blathers plushie. I know I gave you Rover. They didn't have Blathers.
Oh, it's okay. Blathers.
And Blathers is an academic owl for anyone who's never seen him. And he has been, presumably, the director and the curator since the beginning of the Animal Crossing series, which Blathers definitely does not get paid enough to be both a director and a curator.
Oh, for sure. And he's also like the only employee of that museum. So it's like, where is he getting this funding from? It raises a lot of questions.
Is there an Animal Crossing like NSF? Or is there some like Animal Crossing like state funding?
Very curious. Where is this? Who is he writing his grants to, bro?
It's probably Tom Nook. Can you imagine writing a grant to Tom Nook?
Yeah. He probably just, like, is giving him, like, a proposal right then. He's like, no, shut up, just take the money. It's okay, I promise.
Blathers' motivations for the museum in New Horizons, I think, arguably are found on the Animal Crossing New Horizons website. And he's pictured saying, I am exceedingly interested in the ecosystem of the island. And I really like that he says this because it points to the idea that in collecting all of these specimens, you're learning something about the island. So I really like that messaging. And whenever you donate to the museum, Blathers will tell you about the specimen you donated, which I think is a really nice touch, although I think most people skip through it. Like, you're constantly pressing A because you don't want to hear him talk sometimes.
Yeah, it's always like, I always read everything that he says, and then sometimes I accidentally skip it. I'm like, no, I feel so bad, because he, like, I think he actually feels bad if you decline his explanation, right? And I'm like, I am a fraud of a scientist, what have I done? But yeah, what you said, I don't recall his motivation to start a museum on the island, because last time I played Animal Crossing was honestly a while ago. But that's really cool that you found out that he does it because he's specifically interested in the biodiversity of the island, because island biodiversity is actually like a really big research topic, because islands are hotspots of biodiversity in real life, because oftentimes what will happen is that organisms will like raft or somehow otherwise accidentally float towards the island, whether through the air or the water. And then once they get there, and if they successfully establish, which is kind of it's hard to establish oneself on an island, whether you're a human or an animal or a plant. And so once you get there, you're genetically isolated from the rest of the mainland if you're presumably that far away. And so because there's also lots of unexplored niches on this island compared to the mainland, lots of things evolutionarily radiate out super quickly. And so you find a lot of these organisms which are endemic, aka they're not found anywhere else but this like island. And so people go to islands often to study that crazy kinds of life that they don't find anywhere else. So yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate you pointing that out. Actually, one of my favorite stories from undergrad biology is, well, I guess I really liked learning about island biogeography and island theory. And I learned that the leading theory for lemurs, since lemurs are like their own distinct group and they only exist in Madagascar, the leading theory is that they've rafted to Madagascar.
That's really interesting. I can't even imagine like what the ancestor would have looked like, kind of just pathetically floating on a little log towards there.
It's just Zabumafu on a log.
Just this like pathetic, wet, shivering creature washes up on the beach.
Oh my god. Hey everyone, Jillian here. I just want to clarify that in this next segment, it's Brittany and I walking through the Animal Crossing Museum together and talking about our experience. If you've already played the game and you've collected all of the animals and the fossils and you want to skip ahead, you can skip to around minute 33.
So when you walk into the museum, it's like this beautiful entrance hall. It's not very decorative, but I guess it's not the most important space of the museum.
Yeah, we'll wait and see for that. Ah, he went straight in the direction of the most important area.
I love the bug room. This was like my favorite part of the game. I think I like almost cried the first time I saw just like how detailed they made this part of the game.
I know, it's just so beautiful. Like what I really like about this Animal Crossing Museum is like, if I'm not mistaken, it's like probably the most, or well, this is pretty subjective, but I think it was probably the most creative design I'd seen, because like they took really good advantage of the fact that this is a museum in a video game, because like if you have an arboretum this big specifically to showcase insects, they are not going to stay still for everyone to perfectly look at on the branches and trunks. So this was a really good way to make it as open and natural as possible within the confines of a video game, so the insects are always pretty much staying in place. Like, even the butterflies, I'm sure, fly in a cycle, even though it looks quite natural.
I really like that. So what we're looking at right now is there's different kinds of trees and different arrangements of flowers, and they do try to mimic, like, the natural habitat of where these animals would be found. So cicadas being, of course, on more deciduous trees, whereas you've got some of your more tropical beetles on these palm trees. I can't tell what that one is, that beetle, but I love the flabellate antennae.
Hi everyone, Jillian, one more time. I just want to point out that flabellate means that the antennae look like they're fanned out, kind of like antlers or feathery. It's super cool. You have to look it up. Back to the show.
Oh yeah, I think it was a stag beetle. Their antennae are really cute. Something about them, the way that they're just like elbowed or geniculate, and then like those little flabellate parts, endearing. It shows a tiger beetle kind of just like staying stock still on the ground, and every time you approach it, it like runs super fast away, which is true to life. If you've ever tried to catch one, they run super fast and like bounce
they're
away.
They're so hard right to now. Catch sometimes.
It's ridiculous. They're like one of the insects that will like make a fool out of you in public if you try to catch them even with a net. I've definitely, like, fully wiped out on the ground trying to catch a dragonfly before.
Dragonflies are, I think, one of the hardest invertebrates to catch. I do.
Oh, 100%.
I love the bagworm sound. And also, I think it's interesting. They never actually show you what the bagworm looks like. But it's this, like, it's a larvae that encases itself in debris. It's a type of moth, right? Bagworms? Yeah.
It is, yeah. He's just shy.
This big tree in the middle always confused me, because it's not, oh, the garden spider. It's not like a tree you would see in the game. And I always thought that was like a honey smear on there, but I don't, do you know what that is?
I also thought it was either honey or like resin from the tree, because like at night, I forget if it was at night, but there's beetles that come out there and like fight on it or something.
There's
sometimes.
Your dragonflies,
right?
And I love that they're over water.
Dragonfly!
I really like that touch.
That's so true of them. They do like flying near water because they come from there.
Yeah, dragonfly larvae, for those who don't know, are aquatic. They're in the water. And then when they metamorphosize, they're the dragonflies you know and love today.
Mm-hmm. Also, how do you feel that there's like only one spider in this game, right? Because
there's two, and I think it's like the banded garden spider, like some kind of argiope, and then a tarantula. And if we're going on arachnids, there's a scorpion, but yeah, there's like two spiders and a scorpion for arachnids. And the banded garden spider, I think it's classic. I think it's a good educational tool, because it's a spider people will see a lot.
That is true, yeah. I do kind of understand that coming from entomology, although, like, this is kind of hypocritical as we're seeing this, like, big museum exhibit full of so many different kinds of insects, but, like, yeah, people will only see insects and be like, oh, yes, the four types of insects, butterfly, fly, beetle, and, like, I don't even know, like,
so right now we're looking at the butterfly room. It's got this fountain in the center, and it's surrounded by a lot of these flowers, different kinds of flowers. Some are still growing. I've never seen a butterfly garden that looks quite like this, especially with a fountain. I feel like that's kind of a hazard for the butterflies in real life.
I would agree there, yeah, because those water pools are obviously pretty deep because it's a fountain, and you do want to have a fresh water source for the butterflies because they do drink from water, but, like, maybe you guys have already seen, like, guides on the internet for this, but you can create kind of, like, bird baths, but with, like, a tiny bit of water that doesn't fully submerge, like, a bunch of pebbles, so there's absolutely no risk of them drowning. But, yeah, this is, like, a bit
much. It is cool, though, that they mix, like, they have a frog in there, they've got a ladybug, they've got a snail in with the butterfly garden. Yeah. It reminds me a lot of the Insectarium in Montreal, which I really, really highly recommend.
Ooh, yeah, I'll have to go visit that. And yeah, I guess it does kind of also resemble our new butterfly vivarium at the AMNH. There's lots of plants there, and also a water source. So they got all, like, the essentials that the
So now we're looking at some insect displays. They're, like, separate cases with live insects. And there's, like, a mantis, there's some walking sticks together. You've got some, like, classic glass enclosures. Although these are way bigger than I feel like what you'd see. Also, the dung beetle. Shout out to the dung beetle rolling the dung. I really love that piece in there.
That is really adorable. He's just going at it
all hours of the day. We've got mole crickets. We've got an ant colony. Although this is not how you would traditionally see ant colonies represented in an insectarium of this kind. But I do love that they have the cicada underground. I think that's what that is.
Oh my god. True, I didn't even notice that. That is really neat.
It's cool that they show, like, subterranean invertebrates.
Yeah, they covered a good amount of different habitats that insects can inhabit.
And this is my favorite part, is the research room. And we'll get to talk about it a little bit more in depth later. But this, just the first time I saw this and, like, the leaks of this room, my heart was so full because I think this research room is so accurate. What do you think about it?
I think, yeah, it also looks pretty good to me, although I do think it's hilarious that there is a fly swatter there. But yeah, that's typically what, like, a research lab looks like. It's pretty clean and white. You want to keep your surfaces sterile. And it's really nice that it's so easily accessible by visitors. Like, you can see whatever scientists are doing in there, which is the case in a lot of museums. So that's cool. You can see the science going on inside a museum. Now, oh, yeah, it's a beetle fight.
Oh, here, it's a nocturnal part. Oh, wow. Yeah. I forgot. I didn't realize they had this. So we're seeing these beetles fighting on the big tree we were mentioning earlier. It's two different species, which normally doesn't happen. But it is funny. It's like a little beetle fight club happening.
Yeah, they're, like, literally cheering the other combatants on. But yeah, that is actually really cool, because I also noticed that the Atlas moth was no longer on the tree trunk, but, like, I guess being quote-unquote a little bit more active on the top of the tree. So this shift in the day-night cycle shows you that, yes, insects are active at different times of the day, which is very cool. Honestly, I'm so in love with this fish exhibit. Like, they really outdid themselves with the aquatic life here.
Yes, it's now really... we're in the fish side of the museum. And the first time I saw the water, like the way they animated the water, I was speechless. It's gorgeous. And the tank designs themselves are just very aesthetically pleasing, very gorgeous.
Yeah, this exhibit is so well constructed. Like, this and the fossils are probably my favorites in this museum because the direction and construction of the exhibits flow along with the ecological niches and, like, the tree of life. It's so intuitive and pretty, which is what museums should strive for in their modern exhibits. But yeah, I love how, like, it shows, like, the gradation from, like, the headwater to, like, the lower parts of a stream and a river.
Yeah, it's that is one of my favorite parts of the aquarium side too, is the different portions of a stream, like upstream versus downstream, and where you would see some of these fish perhaps.
Yeah, this is where I can't quite say to the accuracy because I don't know what fish are, but...
True. Fish aren't real anyways. That's not a real... It's not a real clade.
No such thing as a fish.
Yeah, I have less to say about fish.
Salmon, I guess, makes sense at a headwater because they're, like, trying to get upstream.
I do like the river fish. It reminds me a lot of the Shedd Aquarium where they have, like the Amazon River sort of displays.
Oh, yeah, that is neat. Yeah, I like how they managed to stuff in so much biodiversity from all over the world on this, like, one island, which doesn't even seem to be tropical because it has, like, seasons to it.
Yeah. It snows, there's fall, it's deciduous. I do like the koi pond.
Yeah, it's so nice and calming. Another frog, gotta have a frog. Also, I love all the puns that they give whenever you catch something. I'll never get sick of that.
Do you have a favorite one?
Huh?
Do you have a favorite one?
I don't know. But I do know that sometimes the puns change in different languages. Because a while ago I tried playing Animal Crossing in Korean. And I think, I don't remember exactly what it was that I caught. I don't know if it was a toe biter or it was some aquatic insect. And it said something about how it breathed from its butt. And I was like, that's so true! Do you have a favorite one?
Oh, my favorite one? I don't think I have a favorite one that sticks in my mind, but I just know I get annoyed when I catch a sea bass.
That's what I was about to say. I don't know what the C plus joke is.
I don't get it either. I do love this like schooled fish exhibit. That's really what we're looking at is like this ocean exhibit. There's a moa moa. There's like sharks. There's a nurse shark, which you would never be able to fit that. Or not a nurse shark, a whale shark.
Oh,
you wouldn't see that in an aquarium. But again, it's a video game. And they also, there's like, you can have a coelacanth, which I love.
Yeah. Depth, who needs her? Yeah, the physics of that anchovy swarm, or not swarm, school. I'm interpolating.
You can tell we're not ichthyologists.
They're about to kill me, dude. But yeah, the physics on this school are like really cool.
Yeah, significantly less to say about fish.
I like how the shark and the other fish are all getting along in harmony, though.
So yeah, now we're in the shark tunnel area, which again took my breath away. It's a marine environment that they're exhibiting here. It's got hammerhead sharks, it's got a red snapper, some pufferfish. Do you know if the pufferfish ever puffs up in this game?
I feel like they should. They would totally include that in the animation cycle, but...
I really like this design of a shark tunnel. I know it's relatively short because it's a video game, but I think it's really cool that it's, like, all around, like, even in front.
Yeah, it's super immersive.
There's, like, four walls. Yeah. And then last, we have our coral reef. Can't forget the coral reef. I don't really have, again, not much to say about fish because I don't know much about them, but I can appreciate the detail work that went into.
Yeah, I like how they made the corals and sponges all like glowing neon colors. I guess they like light up the tanks with UV lights, maybe.
Ooh, true. Now this next part I think is a cute touch where you can look over the exhibit into the water. And that is true of aquariums. It's open tops. Like, even in a shark tunnel, it's open on top. You just can't see it as a visitor, usually. I wish you could, like, feed them or something off of the top.
That would be really cute. Yeah, I do like the little touches where if you stop in and they show you, but very subtly, so it's all part of the design, that you can just, like, stop in a certain area and, like, give a little look over. Oh my god, my jaw dropped. I was just, like, fangirling so hard over this the first time I saw it.
So we're now in the fossil exhibit, and yeah, they have Dunky. They've got my Dunkleosteus, my favorite. And I like how it opens with these, the Devonian. I don't think they say it explicitly, but a lot of these fossils are more Devonian Cambrian era, or very, very ancient animals, and it takes you through time. And the floor is supposed to illustrate like an evolutionary tree, which the accuracy of you could probably debate. But I like the idea, right? Taking you on a walk through time. And this is very reminiscent to me of the Chicago Field Museum's different like walkthrough. I don't remember what it's called, but it takes you through all the mass extinctions.
Ooh, that is really neat. Yeah, I love how the tree serves as like a literal path for you to walk on and like follow along.
And the way the fossils are articulated, or the way the fossils are articulated are just so gorgeous. So gorgeous, so much detail. I mean, I love that it's also somewhat to scale. It's like the bigger dinosaurs are going to take up more of the room. And please don't kill me for saying dinosaurs. I know not all of these are technically dinosaurs.
Right as it zooms in on like the first mammal or something, Duramaya.
And I also love this KPG boundary asteroid. If you watched or listened to our last episode, the Galarian mass extinction, we talk a little bit about the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. Sebastian and I covered that together.
Oh, he didn't stand in like the spot where it shows you like the asteroid coming for Earth though, or maybe he'll do that at the end.
Oh yeah, isn't it like hanging in the ceiling?
Yeah, if you like stand, it like zooms out from the whole room and shows it just like approaching all of the dinosaurs in the exhibit, and it's so ominous. Like they even play like a little extra note in the background music. Yeah, it's super foreboding. I love it. Pachycephalosaurus, one of my favorite dinosaurs. Although I don't know much about dinosaurs, but still, I love him. It's also why Rampardos is probably one of my favorite fossil Pokemon.
Ooh, I don't know if I have a favorite fossil Pokemon. Show us the asteroid.
Show us how they died! Well, he does show... This is another spot where if you pause for a second, like, it'll show you a different perspective of the museum, which is cool. Oh, he skipped it. Well, onto the next room, which is still really cool. This was incredible.
Yes, this is one of my favorite parts of the fossil exhibit. So what we're looking at is it shows the extant groups from which these extinct species that, you know, are derived from extinct species. So you've got like the mammoth leading into the elephant. And you've got the Irish, what is it called? An Irish deer leads into like the modern deer.
Mm-hmm.
And the extant groups, so the existing ones that haven't gone extinct, are all modeled after the villagers, which is really cute. Yep. And there's a spot for you to stand in after the Australopithecus, which is an ancient, it's thought to be an ancestor to humans.
Yeah, and then like the little spotlight glows above you. It's so cute. And it really puts into perspective that like we are but one of like billions of branches of life. It's very humbling, but also so endearing and cool.
There was a really cool painting.
Smirking emoji.
That got shared on Twitter, and I wish I remembered. The video's over. I wish I remembered who the artist was, but it's called Two Earthlings, and it's a painting of a woman looking at what I believe is a T-Rex skull.
Yes, I know that painting.
Yes,
it's so hard.
So moving to think about it, that we've shared this planet with all of these now gone species.
I know, and it's so exciting thinking about how, like, yeah, Earthling is usually referred to as, like, oh yeah, just humans, like Earthlings versus Martians or whatever, but no, like, Earthling refers to, like, the endless billions of species that we share and used to share this planet with. So it's cool putting your humanity into the perspective of all of the life on Earth, because we are just a little bit of the life on Earth. And we should consider how we share this world with the others more.
So obviously all of the things in the museum that players collect in Animal Crossing are based on real organisms. They're a pure one-for-one. And I found this awesome article on Polygon by Karen Hahn titled, Animal Crossing Gets the Real-Life Museum Details Right. So first off, how do you feel about that sentiment, Brittany? Do you think that's an accurate statement, semi-accurate? Is there a percentage you want to give?
For the accuracy of, like, the animals that you would find, I would say,
Or, like, the accuracy for how it represents a real museum.
Oh, the museum. Yeah, I would say that it does, like, a pretty good job. The design is, like, super engaging, and, it's not only, like, exciting to look at, but at the same time, it, like, guides you through, like, especially in the fossil room, like, it guides you through how time has moved and what animals are in which time period. I would say something that would have been like even better to add would be like plaques describing what animals you're seeing, describing their interactions with each other. But of course, you can only fit so much into a video game, I suppose. But yeah, that's, you definitely not only just show like, look at this cool thing we found. You also have to explain like its context in history or whenever it might have existed. It might still be alive right now. So yeah, the point of a museum is not only to point at the cool stuff, but also to learn its place in our world.
So in this article, they interviewed Munisa Ahmed, an exhibition developer at the Field Museum, Elizabeth Mustine Allison, the chief of exhibit production at the National Museum of Natural History, so the Smithsonian, and Vivian, I think it's Chakinsky. I don't know if you know this person, but Vivian Trudkinski, the director of science visualization at the American Museum of Natural History. And so they're all asked for their take on Blather's Museum. And first and foremost, I learned that the T-Rex in the fossil room is modeled after Sue at the Field Museum. And so for the listeners who don't know, Sue is the most complete skeleton of a T-Rex to date. And she is housed at the Field Museum in Chicago. And if you haven't visited Sue in Chicago yet, if you ever get the opportunity, I highly recommend. I've been visiting Sue since I was a kid. And I remember when I was little, my mom took me to this traveling Sue exhibit. And when we got there, Sue wasn't actually there, the skeleton of the T-Rex. And I remember bawling, being like, where is Sue? I was promised she would be here. So my parents shortly after took me to Chicago to see the real Sue. And so that was the first time I had visited Sue. But she's been there for decades and inspiring so many scientists. I recently read a paper by Carol Lee, who works on the genetics of copepods, and she's a Korean-American researcher. And she had this really awesome like afterword that she included in one of her big research articles. And so she was asked about her experience as being, you know, a woman in STEM and being an Asian woman in STEM, specifically Korean. And she wrote that one of her first encounters with science, or one of her first super memorable encounters with science, was at the Field Museum and looking at Sue the T-Rex. And as I was reading this excerpt from a Korean American researcher, I was in my Sue sweatshirt reading this for genetics class, and being a Korean American in STEM, I think I almost cried. It was just like the perfect timing. So like many other scientists to this day, like, Sue is so impactful, and I love that they include her in this game because she's an icon. Let's be real. She is an icon. And to this day, I get emotional seeing Sue at the Field Museum. They've got this beautiful light show where they talk about how Sue was discovered, how her skeleton has changed over time based on the things we've learned about dinosaurs and about the T-Rex. And it ends with this this silhouette behind the fossil of Sue roaring. It literally brings me to tears. I can't even describe how powerful it is.
No, yeah, I totally feel it. And like, while I was listening to you tell the story, like, I just have like the biggest grin on my face. It's so important to see like people who are like you, like, being representation in STEM. And it's like, oh, we were inspired by the same thing, so we can both succeed together. So it's really nice to see. I also have a really chaotic story of me going to see Sue. So my brother, who is 11 years older than me, he went to University of Chicago and he graduated. And this was when I was about like in fifth grade or something. So we went to Chicago, and at the time I was a huge dinosaur kid. So I was like, we have to see Sue. And so my dad, who was totally unfamiliar with Chicago, was like, okay, we're going to take a public transport bus and we're going to go to the Field Museum. And he asks a taxi driver? I forget. No, it had to be a taxi driver, because he asked the cab driver to go to the Field Museum. And we get there and we go inside this big building, and there were a bunch of like railroad cars in this room. And I was like, oh, is this just open? Does the Field Museum just open with like a historical exhibit of Chicago? That's kind of interesting. And the lady was like, this is like the Transportation Museum of Chicago. And I was like, how did this guy totally mishear what we said? So we ended up having to take a bus to get to the actual Field Museum. And by then we had run out of so much time that we literally like headed for a beeline to go see Sue and like immediately left. And I was like, well, that wasn't terribly cathartic, but at least I got to see her. So yeah. And I agree that museums are probably a big driving force of what inspires so many scientists to become scientists, like the really iconic names in the field, like the Field Museum or the AMNH or the Smithsonian. Like, they just contain such a huge myriad of really cool specimens that like always like wow these children. And I remember being a child like that myself. Like, I took a field trip to the AMNH in second grade, and I just remember being like totally overwhelmed by how cool all of these specimens were and that people had like discovered them and were still doing science on them. And it was definitely a big part of my journey into science. And then even in high school, the Field Museum came out with the Brain Scoop, and AMNH had also a YouTube series called Shelf Life. And watching those made me aware of like, oh, collections exist inside museums. Like, this is where I want to work. And from then on, like, that's how that basically guided my career path. And so full circle moment, I'm working at the AMNH. Very cool.
And Trukinski, who is with the American Museum of Natural History in this article, pointed out that some of the features in Animal Crossing reminded her of AMNH, which I thought was really cool, specifically the fourth floor. I don't know how familiar you are with the fourth floor, because I know you mostly work with entomology, but on the fourth floor of AMNH, they distribute the animals across cladograms, so the different groups of organisms. And it seemed like the people they interviewed for this article really liked this feature in the game. The idea of telling the story of evolution through these tangible fossils and beautiful visuals of the tree of life. And I couldn't agree more.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with them. And that is why, like, I just like internally sobbed the first time I saw that exhibit in the game when I played it for the first time. I was just like, this is such an amazing example of visual storytelling in a museum that immerses the viewer in the history and context of the objects that they're showcasing. And now that I think of it, yeah, it might really be inspired by how the AMNH is, because the fourth floor, the entomology wing is actually right above the fourth floor. So I often go downstairs and see everything while I'm leaving work. But yeah, the dinosaurs and all of the fossils on the fourth floor are distributed through time. And every time I go visit there to like take my friends through, I always get lost and end up somehow traversing the thing backwards through time. So I like start in the Cenozoic and end up going backwards, or I just visit them totally out of order somehow. I'm really bad with directions. But yes, it is super cool. They like point arrows like this way to the origin of mammals, this way to the origin of vertebrates. It's so cool. And it like always, I don't know, I just always am overcome with this sense of majesty, even though I'm lost and really have no sense of direction. But yeah,
they all also pointed out how accurate the research room and the bug hall is, and that really cracked me up, because I also thought it was relatively accurate. I mean, minus some of the cheesier things like the DNA statue but I mean, you more so me, like I had the opportunity to spend a few days helping with the Field Museum's collections, identifying some of their unidentified spiders. And you, of course, work at the American Museum of Natural History. So seeing this room, I was like, oh, yeah, that is what it looked like. That is pretty much it. Minus the live specimen. I think that's pretty contextual, but I thought it was accurate.
Yeah, it for sure was. And like, it's interesting because you can see that this museum, of course, in the context of the game, is like brand spanking newly built. And so the museum is kind of like an architectural mishmash of like not only different styles, but incredibly different time periods, because you have like the main parts of the building that were there since its inception in the late 1800s. And you have like new buildings like the Gilder Center, which were built literally last year. And so in the area that I work, the offices and labs are like super duper old. So they don't look like the lab that we saw in the insect wing in the game. But if you do go to the newer parts of the building, yes, the labs really do look like that. So it would have been kind of funny excuse me, to see like really old, like crusty labs, because that is an important and endearing part of the building and its history. And good research still can be done in there. But yeah, it's just funny to kind of think about the contrast between those two things. But of course, like the new up-to-date labs are very important to have too, because their equipment, the new equipment that we've developed, especially in like DNA sequencing, is like totally invaluable to our research today and understanding like evolutionary relationships. It's very, very helpful now.
One of the best quotes from the Polygon article, and it has nothing to do with organisms, but two of the museum staff pointed out that they were overjoyed with the number of benches present throughout the museum, because apparently that's some of like the number one feedback museums get is more benches, which the more I think about it, the more I think it is true. There's less places to sit. You're always on your feet. And I think I would also like more benches. But ultimately, this article shows how carefully the museum in Animal Crossing was designed. And that makes me really happy as a lover of museums. I really loved this Polygon article. It's definitely worth the read if you're interested in it. And for listeners, I'll post some of the sources for this episode in the Discord so you can see some of these articles for yourself. But a huge part of working in museums and collections is identifying the organism. So Brittany, you work in some of the odonate identification, and obviously you need to know what's in your collections, although oftentimes it takes some time for things to get identified in collections, which is why I was there. But as a biologist, one of my favorite phrases I hear from people is, oh, I know what that is. I saw it in Animal Crossing, which I do this too whenever I'm at like zoos and aquariums and insectariums. I'm like, oh yeah, it's just like Animal Crossing. And Animal Crossing has this amazing history of teaching players how to identify animals. And that's one of my favorite things about the game, and not just animal identification, but an appreciation for nature. And I found several papers, research papers, that speak to the importance of Animal Crossing and its contributions to science education and museum education. So the first one that I found is by Caroler and Filinois, or 2023, I think that's how you say their name. And it's titled, Video Games as a Tool for Ecological Learning, The Case of Animal Crossing. And this paper examined whether players gained species identification skills and if it transferred to real life models. So participants were asked to first rank their personal interest in nature and then identify animals from photos. So for example, there was a picture of like a tarantula versus a wolf spider, and they were seeing if people could tell the difference based on their experience with Animal Crossing. And results showed that people who had played Animal Crossing were better at identifying these real life animals than those who had never played the game before. And ultimately, the authors argue that this is, you know, evidence for the power of video games enhancing ecological learning and the use of video games as a valuable tool for science education. And like I said, I love hearing people say, oh, I know this, it's from Animal Crossing. And I feel like at least 7 times out of 10, they're correct.
For sure, yeah. Oh, God. The power of, like, Animal Crossing and, like, Pokemon to teach people about nature is, like, always so touching to me. And like you, I have heard so many people say, like, I know this thing from Animal Crossing, like, just by walking through, like, the Gilder Center Insectarium, and I'm like, yes, my job is done. But yeah, it's like, it's such a wonderful gateway. I actually once worked with a PhD student who described games like Pokemon as a gateway drug into taxonomy, and she was right. But yeah, because, like, Pokemon is how I eventually got into biology myself. But anyway, back to the point. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
Good.
Good thing this is not live.
I also found an article by Fisher, Yo, and Rundle from 2021 titled...
Wait, could Rundell? Like, what, was it Rebecca Rundell?
Probably.
That was one of my advisors back in college. That's so crazy. Wait,
oh, that's...
What are all of their names again?
I think it's Fisher, Yo, and Rundle. Let me find the article.
Rundell is the only one of those names that I possibly recognize. But
where is it? Oh, yeah. It's this one.
Oh, also, what I wanted to continue saying before is that Yeah, so all of the, or most of the insects and other animals that you see in Animal Crossing, but especially the insects, they choose really, really charismatic examples, which are, of course, the best way to get someone hooked into something. You want to show them, it's just good advertising and marketing strategy. You want to show them all of, like, the cool, flashy animals and let them know, like, this is only a taste of what we have in this big animal group, because not only do we have even more of these flashy things, but this is literally like the most subatomic tip of the iceberg you can get, because I really hope so many of the people who adore the insects in Animal Crossing get to know that there are over a million species of insects out there, ranging from all sizes, all colors, all walks of life. And so it's just like a really good way to entice people into getting into the field, like, and showing them kind of like what's like the nuances of the field, like, so you can see in what I really find cool in life is just kind of diving into different fields and seeing like what are the things that they kind of like meme about amongst themselves, what are the things that they think are like, oh yeah, this is like the cool thing to study, or like, oh, this is the thing everyone think is actually really popular, when to newcomers this is like the coolest thing they've ever seen and had never heard about before. So I remember, I think, talking to my partner, who is also an entomologist, but he's been at it like way longer than I have. So I've been interested in insects since I was in college. He's been interested in insects since he was like a little kid. So he knows like an infinite amount of information compared to like me. And so I was preparing insects for exhibition at the Gilder Center. And I was like, ooh, look at the Madagascar sunset moth. That was an Animal Crossing. So cool. And I always like to joke that like, oh my God, I can't believe Animal Crossing invented insects. That was so cool of them. He was like, yeah, these are like super common and you see them like in insect shows all the time. So it's really interesting to like see your progression of information be like, this is the coolest thing I've never heard of. I can't believe no one's talking about this. And once you get further into the field and gain more experience, you're like, oh, this is actually like a super common thing that everyone knows about, but that doesn't have to make it any less special, because it's like, oh, I'm so glad this many people know about it, but think about how many more people would enjoy this field if they also knew about it. So that's what I really like about Animal Crossing, showing people these like really cool insects and hopefully getting them more into that kind of thing.
Yeah, so in this article by Fisher, Yeo, and Rundle 2021 titled "Could Nintendo's Animal Crossing Be a Tool for Conservation Messaging?" It's this cool paper that talks about the kinds of information that people could possibly get from Animal Crossing, and also suggestions for how Animal Crossing could make this even more educational and more useful as an educational tool. And I think more than anything, the figures are super interesting from this paper, as they show what percentage of animals you can catch in the game that are endangered or threatened in real life. And it also, there's a figure that breaks down how many villagers belong to like each taxonomic group, like mammals versus birds versus, you know, other things. And at the end, they list the future recommendations for Animal Crossing, or recommendations in general for video games that have the intention of educating players. And those recommendations are, number one, when donating catchable species to the museum, increase the consistency with which information about conservation is reported. So giving the IUCN status, CITES, so is it endangered, is it vulnerable, is it threatened? Enhancing, number two is enhancing the information provided by the plaques. So you could also put this information in the plaques, you know, when you click on them in the museum.
Oh yeah, agreed.
They call for diverse taxa in the villagers, to include non-vertebrate, non-mammal species, which I think is really funny. And I could go on about that.
But it would be kind of hard to make them make an invertebrate taxa anthropomorphic, because everything is like kind of a humanoid shape, even like the octopuses.
Yeah.
But I don't know. They just like, I see artists do all different kinds of things these days, so I'm sure it would be possible if they tried and to make it look good even, it would be possible.
Number four I thought was really interesting. They say that there should be an integration of the notion of sustainable resource use. So the example they give is the beehive could increase the availability of catchable bees, and overfishing may decrease the waters or decrease the catchable fish. So if you like catch so many fish at a certain amount of time, then you're like less likely to see fish, which, really, I don't know how sustainable.
This would put an enormous strain on the Animal Crossing economy. How else am I going to make my income with Tom Nook
and the min maxers?
Yeah, right.
Number five, ensure that the in-game phenomena, so like the seasonality, reflects real-world ecological life histories rather than Japanese cultural associations, which I disagree with number five. I think it's super important to have cultural representation in games. So I'm mostly going to ignore that one. Because like while I understand it's important to reflect real-world ecological life histories, it's also important to reflect culture and to bring the cultural side to people too. So yeah, I don't know. I disagree with the authors on that one.
No, yeah. And it's also not like it's anything to do with like, it's not like anything super pressing about cultural representation to a global audience. Like, I think that's a fine detail to leave in specifically in reference with Japanese culture.
Number six, remove the mechanism for re-releasing invasive species, e.g. citrus longhorn beetle back onto the island. That is, I think, a really funny one. I see where they're headed with it. Like, you know, maybe you get a little warning. Like, oh, this is invasive. Don't release it.
I agree with that. I thought it was super funny because, like, sometimes I'll, like, be fishing a lot and my inventory's full. And then I'm just like, I'm going to release this freshwater fish back into the ocean and I'm sure it'll be fine. And the game lets you do it with no repercussions. We're going to pretend we don't know what happens to that fish. He just goes happily swimming along because water's water. It's like fine, you know.
Number seven asks for Blathers to change his attitude towards invertebrates using a mechanism or event through which he can overcome his entomophobia, which I think that is an interesting spin. Like there's something that you accomplish in the game that helps him overcome his fear of insects. And the origin of his fear is actually discussed in, I believe it's New Leaf. And he tells the player that he had this experience where a mantis egg sac hatched on his desk as a child. Mm-hmm. And that freaked him out for the rest of his life. But they don't include this in New Horizons. And it does make me a little sad that it contributes to this, you know, idea that bugs are scary. So I do agree with the authors on this one. I wish Blathers wasn't scared of insects. But I also thought, you know, when I first played this game, maybe it was supposed to be kind of a joke that it's an owl that's afraid of insects because a lot of birds eat invertebrates.
Right? Yeah.
But I don't know.
I totally agree with that. I also, like, as an entomologist, was just like, why did they have to make this very passionate naturalist afraid of the thing that everyone's also afraid of and wants to kill every second they get? But yeah, I also agree in the sense that, like, okay, it was probably a joke because, like, oh, a bird afraid of insects, that's kind of funny. And I do think they put the Blathers' origin story of his fear of insects in New Horizons, because that's where, I'm pretty sure that's where I heard the origin story.
Oh, really? I haven't played in a while, so don't trust me.
No, yeah, me neither, honestly. But yeah, so I was kind of like hung up on the fence because I was like, it's a funny character trait for this iconic character to have, but on the other hand, even though I think it's kind of harmful to public education, it's like, is it really worth throwing that character trait away that makes him unique? But I really like the author's take that there is like a little arc in the game where you can help him overcome his fear of that. So it's another really interesting way that a character can like interact uniquely with an NPC, which I think is like already kind of a problem in New Horizons, because I think kind of the character interactions in that game were a little bit lackluster, at least compared to New Leaf. Those are the only two Animal Crossing games that I've played. But I think it would be super cool if they did that. That's a really cool suggestion they made.
They compensate for it with the introduction of Flick, the chameleon who collects insects.
True.
And he's like super psyched about them and he makes you little statues of them. So I think that helps balance it out and you get like both sides of that. But I'm always for like, I guess like it's good to acknowledge that entomophobia exists and maybe players can relate to this idea of like, I'm scared, but I'm super fascinated. Because I do get that a lot from people I talk to where they say they are fearful of invertebrates, but they're mm-hmm. interested in them. So I don't know. I feel like it could go either way. But last, the authors suggest incorporating an avenue by which players are incentivized to invest their own assets into conservation, e.g. by donating Nook Miles to a conservation cause, players receive villager positivity, island star rating increasing, or increase availability of rare catchables. I really liked that idea because in Animal Crossing, I believe is New Leaf, you could actually donate to this like impoverished community and then they would send you gifts, which, you know, take that as you will, but it's taking that concept and applying it to conservation. So maybe a character could start sending bells, like they did in New Leaf, to a conservation cause, and then they could get a statue of that threatened or endangered species or something, or some kind of reward for doing that, which is, I think, would be really cool.
Yeah, I could see that being pretty interesting. They already did add, like, so many of these, like, really new game mechanics into the game, so that could also be a really cool avenue to kind of demonstrate, like, the real-life applications of caring about conservation and the benefits you can do that, like, individually and, like, where you're putting your money and resources to. So that could be cool, yeah.
The last article I wanted to talk about was a journal article by Amy Hansmerk titled Let's Play in Lockdown, Museums, Interpretation, and Video Games in Convergence During the COVID-19 Pandemic. The article covers many things, and I, you know, we're short for time, so I don't want to go too deep into it. But one of my favorite parts of the article is when Hansmerk talks about how museums use the pandemic to become more virtual than ever, not just, you know, uploading their collections online and creating these virtual tours, but actually improving the museum's engagement with communities through events that were hosted in Animal Crossing. So one of the examples Hansmerk uses is hashtag Animal Crossing, which was hosted by Merle, the Museum of English Rural Life. And the museum asked players to use their exhibition titled Smocks, Smocking, Smocked. So it's like an older clothing design. So take inspiration from that exhibit. And then they asked people to design their own smock in Animal Crossing and post it online. Because in the game, you can design your own clothing. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a really interesting way for museums to connect with people virtually, not just through like their museum website, but it's through the video game itself. So this is not in the article, but as of this recording, I also wanted to point out that the Seattle Aquarium is currently hosting a collaborative event with Animal Crossing where visitors are given real life, like the real Animal Crossing experience at the aquarium. So there's all these cardboard cutouts of Blathers and fellow villagers giving information on the aquarium. And I think my favorite thing I've seen in this collaborative event is there's a plushie of Gulliver, the seagull that always gets, well, I guess I shouldn't say seagull. I'll get in trouble with the ornithologist.
Yeah.
Seabird. I think
the proper term is gull. Just plain gull.
Gull. Yeah. I mean, his name is Gulliver.
Yeah.
But Gulliver is the character that's known to like wash up on shore, and he's always dazed and confused. And so they have a little washed up Gulliver knocked out on top of some rocks.
That is amazing, and I love that so much. Yeah, the pandemic was a lot of like really interesting situations in place for education, because like we all suddenly had to move online, but the way some people took advantage of that online atmosphere was really cool. Like you said, with that interactive event with like designing your own smock and Animal Crossing, and then even now when the pandemic is quote unquote over, with Seattle like putting up like all of these interactive educational exhibits featuring Animal Crossing characters, like it's really cool that people are using the visibility and popularity of these media characters to kind of promote education of the real life, excuse me, animals that you might see in the game. This was probably at least like a couple years ago at this point, but I do know there was, I think, a pop-up exhibit somewhere in Japan of fossil animals where they put up they put up fake fossil skeletons of Pokemon alongside their real life fossil counterparts, and it was like, yes, this is how you do science communication and tying it into like popular media.
Can tour it online. I can include that in the sources. Yeah, you can do a virtual tour of it. It's super cool.
Yeah, I was so mad I couldn't see it. I'll have to go look that up when you send the link.
So as we've talked about, collecting and interacting with the Animal Crossing Museum has been significantly educational for people. I mean, these were just like three of a handful of articles that center education through Animal Crossing. And this educational component goes for museums in real life. Museums are a real thing, obviously, and they're really important components of education and science. And I would believe that museums and collections have existed since humans have existed. I mean, many humans have natural interests in collecting and displaying specimen. And I found out that one of the oldest known museums is, and I probably am not saying this right, but the Enigaldi Nana's Museum in what is today known as Iraq. And it was thought to have been built around 2,553 years ago. So this is one of the world's oldest museums on record. And most early museums were private collections, right? You've probably heard of, you know, a cabinet of curiosities or something. And as collections began to become the museums we know today, the first Western-style museums were only open to the upper and middle class. But modern public museums that became more accessible took on popularity around the 19th century and through the 20th century. So that's just a little bit of museum history for you. Because like, doing this episode, I realized I don't actually know that much about the history of museums in terms of, you know, what were some of the earliest museums? What were people collecting? What were people teaching each other historically? And how were museums used across time? But I think one of the reasons museums and collections are so important is because they're often one of the only ways we can connect with the past. But that's not just the comfortable past either. They're ways we can connect with the uncomfortable past and the uncomfortable, and I guess uncomfortable is not totally the right word here, you know, the bad things that have happened in history and the bad things people have done. So I love museums, but I also want to acknowledge that they're not perfect entities. And like first and foremost, I think people often see taxidermied specimen. There's a lot of really old taxidermied specimen that exist in some of the, at least the US's largest museums. And it's inevitable that people ask where specimen come from. And historically, there were a lot more people who were killing animals and plants solely for collections. And I think a prime example of this is John J. Audubon, who's, you know, the famed avian illustrator. He was objectively a horrible human being because yeah. He was deeply racist. He had a very awful participation in the slave trade, and he was active and willing in the desecration of indigenous graves, going so far as to steal remains of those buried in graves and giving them to museum collections, which, by the way, some museums still haven't made the proper effort to return those remains. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, this is all to say that it was common back then to hire people like Audubon to kill animals for collections. And this practice is much more restricted in modern times. There's a lot more paperwork that's involved. This does still happen, and I don't really want to comment on it either way. But this, I just want to acknowledge that this is the foundation upon which many of today's museums are built. And I also want to acknowledge that there are so many stolen artifacts in museums across different countries and cultures. And I didn't want to make an episode about museums without also talking about how there are still tremendous reparations to be made, especially when it comes to indigenous artifacts. So recently in the news, the Chicago Field Museum has covered up some of its Native American displays to comply with the Native American Graves Protection and Reparation Act. So there's no human remains on display at the Field Museum, but there are a lot of artifacts that could have been involved in burials. And so a recent change to the act requires consent from lineal descendants and or affiliated Native American tribes or Native Hawaiian organizations for Native American sacred objects, objects of cultural patrimony, funerary objects, and or human remains to be on view. So I'm really glad these steps are being taken. They're slow and often small steps, but someday I hope to see artifacts being rightfully returned and more museums confronting, you know, the history that they've been involved in. And I do want to give credit to the museums who are doing this. You know, like I mentioned, the Field Museum is actively working with local tribes, and they've also had several exhibitions where they talk about this darker history and this darker side of museum collections and being transparent about it. So I appreciate the museums that are working towards that.
Yeah, that was this is a really good acknowledgement to make, because even though I and anyone else in a museum who works purely in the zoological aspects of it, like museums as a whole are like deeply colonial institutions, and even though I work with animals, not humans, well, like humans are animals, but you know what I mean. Anyway, those specimens that were collected possibly around like a century ago were probably done so not in like the best ethical ways possible, as in they were not collected necessarily with the consent or collaboration of people indigenous to the area that they were collecting in. They might have been doing it indiscriminately, like you said, especially with like vertebrates. Like the reason the Migratory Bird Act exists is because of the extinction or near extinction of lots of bird populations. Probably the passenger pigeon is one of the most famous examples, because they were said to have swarmed in so many numbers that it would block out the sky whenever they took to the air. And now they're just completely gone. So thankfully we have laws in place like that now to protect, even if it's just at least like our vertebrate animals. And yeah, there's a lot of debate around the anthropological studies and collections of museums today. Like the AMNH is no exception. Like you said, the Field Museum was doing updates to some of its collections and exhibits because of updates to NAGPRA. I think I can say this because the New York Times published an article about it, but the AMNH just closed two of its halls relating to indigenous peoples of North America. I think one of them was those that live on the East Coast. I forget exactly which geographic area they're from, but yeah, they closed down two of those halls because they exhibit lots of material that might have to be subject to repatriation or consent from the indigenous peoples that they came from. So yeah, repatriation and decolonization is certainly a very active process, even though it is a slow one. I'm glad the museum has taken steps to address those and correct those things. Especially, I don't even know how many years ago this was at this point, but we all might have seen this very controversial statue of Theodore Roosevelt on the front steps of the museum's facade. And it's portrayed in really not a great way, because he's on horseback, clearly elevated above a black man and an indigenous man, both of whom are like shirtless and kind of in an implicated position of subordinates to him. And so that statue was eventually taken down. And on the first floor of the museum, it's interesting because I think there is like a diorama of colonizers meeting for the first time, like making first contact with indigenous peoples. And now the glass case of that diorama is now labeled like, I forget what the exact wording is, but they're basically asking the viewer to consider the implications of, I guess, the way things are portrayed in this exhibit. Like, what would we have might have changed about this today? So it's interesting that they're keeping some of these potentially insensitive materials up, but also addressing, like, this is what we did, but we see that this is wrong now. And we see this is exactly why it's wrong, what we could have done better, and why we're not going to be doing things like this anymore. So I'm glad at least those things have been done and they're continuing to address this problem today. Yeah.
Right. And I think on the organismal side too, museums still have a long way to go and collections have a long way to go in terms of, you know, there are organizations actively sending out people to collect from countries where sometimes I often feel they don't create the proper connections with the indigenous groups that exist in those areas. And I think, you know, Madagascar is a great example of that. Not like, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody here, but in terms of like historically, right, a form of colonization is Western science, mm-hmm. and sending people to collect organisms from these different countries and cultures without talking with those communities and, you know, really connecting with the local communities and taking credit for things that the local communities should be receiving credit for. Because oftentimes, you know, we get these like, oh, it's this new species or this was discovered by science, when in reality, a lot of these discoveries were first made by the people who lived there. So that's one thing to consider too when you walk through museums or you hear about, you know, conservation efforts, really thinking about are the right people involved? Are the people in their land who are affected involved in this project? And again, I really just want to put that out there in terms of like, we still have progress to make in terms of museums and doing the right thing by people and by organisms.
Yeah, absolutely. Like what you just described, the phenomenon of like people from Western society like going in and like quote unquote discovering new species when it's like the people who live there forever like already knew all about them. It's like called parachute research, and it still goes on today, unfortunately, And that's why we need to emphasize now more than ever that science is a highly collaborative worldwide effort. And so, yeah, we should make efforts to communicate with the scientists who live in an area that we might want to go to and do research at, and include them in publications that we want to make, because discoveries do not necessarily only qualify when they're published. Like, knowledge has existed forever in different places and peoples, and like, we can't just like take that from them, basically, or like, we should stop doing that and just involve them.
So I want to mention that in the United States, there are more than 35,000 museums, and UNESCO estimates that the number of museums worldwide is around 104,000. That means that the U.S. makes up around one-third of all museums. And this isn't just, you know, the big museums. This includes smaller local museums, too, which are just important as the large ones. So, Brittany, you work at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Did you know that the AMNH has over 34 million specimens and artifacts in their collections?
I did, yeah. Point of pride.
So I'm going to read all this out loud because I really like this, but the AMNH website page on scientific collections says, and this is about, you know, the importance of museums as the home of education and research, quote, "Collections provide the evidence from which scientists derive scientific knowledge, including knowledge that is directly applied to critical issues facing our society, such as documenting biological and cultural diversity in times of unprecedented environmental destruction, developing a baseline understanding of the effects of climate change and other environmental threats, tracking host and parasite species responsible for infectious disease, determining the actual and potential impact of invasive pests on crop plants, discovering biomedicines, monitoring the changes in marine resources such as fisheries, examining complex histories of human innovation, trade, technology, and material, and understanding how human changes to Earth's chemical cycles affect sustainability. Collections allow us to study questions such as, how do planets form? How do the Earth's interacting physical, chemical, and biological processes work? What are the species on Earth? How do new species form? How do genes influence the structure and function of organisms? What is the origin of the human species? How do languages and other features of human societies emerge and diversify? How is the climate changing and how is it affecting species, including humans? What do mass extinction events and climates of the past tell us about our current environmental crisis? As libraries of biodiversity, collections also help establish species identities. When a new animal is discovered, the International Commission on Zoological Nomenclature requires that the representative specimen for that species, the type specimen, or holotype, is deposited in an accredited museum. How a species is defined affects legislation for its protection, and almost all species of plants and animals are defined on the basis of museum specimens, including specimens held in the collections of the American Museum of Natural History." End quote. So the main takeaway I want to give here is that museums are not just important in terms of being available for the public to learn and for communities to engage with each other, but museums and collections are important for science. And there's so much that goes on behind the scenes of museums and inside collections. It's almost incomprehensible to me. You know, what you experience in a museum is just scratching the surface of what they're actually doing. And so now I think is a good time to talk about what's happening right now in the museum and collections world. Because personally, I don't think there's enough attention or public knowledge on how museums work. And, you know, collections as well, not just collections in museums, but collections outside of museums and those other institutions. So museums and collections are a big part of many communities. As we look to the future and think about how museums and collections are the backbone of so much scientific education and research, a lot of museums and collections themselves are in precarious positions, mostly financially. And even some of the museums, even some of the largest museums in the United States, are operating under very stressful circumstances. And most museums legally operate as nonprofits and are often fighting tooth and nail for many, many funding sources. I doubt there's a museum that functions on a single funding source. They're often operating on many different funding sources. And not only that, but some collections are fading out of existence because of the idea that they don't bring in enough money or that there's not enough interest in them. So Brittany, I wanted to ask you, do you want to talk a little bit about what's happening right now in February 2024 with Duke University and what is happening with their herbaria?
Oh my God.
And I guess, like, first, describe what an herbaria is for listeners at home.
Right. So I've never personally worked in one, but an herbarium is just a natural history collection for plants. And although, like, the word herbarium kind of only implies plants, to my knowledge, you can also have lots of other quote-unquote plant-like organisms in there. Like, I know Duke Herbarium also has fungi and lichen in their collections. They have like a wide array of like vascular plants, mosses, lichens and fungi in there. And to my knowledge, Duke is the second largest private university herbarium in the United States with over 800,000 specimens, over half of which are plants. And they have something like 2,000 type specimens in there. So that is crazy. They hold a wealth of taxonomic, not only just taxonomic information, baseline taxonomic information, but everything that Jillian said could be used for collections and much, much more. So the fact that such an insane resource that has been used by not only the American scientific community, but collaborators from all over the world is just utterly astounding to me. I'm quite new to the museum profession, but I have never heard of a collection, especially one so reputable as Duke's, getting shut down. Like, I haven't been able to concentrate at work because I was just so shocked this whole week at what is going down there. I'm just like, yeah. I'm trying to get basically as many people on social media to sign the petition and email their administrators as possible. It's just crazy to me.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about how people can help with this effort specifically for the Duke collections?
Yeah, I guess I can send you the petition and you can link that in the podcast description. And also, I don't know if I should say this off the record or not. I don't know. It's already been put so much on Twitter and like even, news outlets already, but there's like administrators that you can email. I guess you could also put them in the description, I suppose, because yeah, it would be troublesome to hear an email and try to memorize that from there. But yeah, you can email administrators and sign the petition, I suppose. That's what I've been doing. I'm planning to email them next week.
Yeah, so listeners, if you want to help save the herbarium collection, like Brittany said, we'll link the petition so that you can put your name on it, and we'll also provide resources so that you can email the proper people if you want to help preserve and protect this collection. And on a personal note, for me, like one of my committee members was an herbarium curator for my master's, and I have so much love for the herbarium that I didn't really work in it, but it was a place that I called home in terms of like I did my research in the herbarium. I was looking at spiders amongst the plants in the herbarium, and knowing how important our collection was to our university makes me so sad for the Duke community, because our herbarium was used for education, first and foremost for students. We would spend our botany classes, you know, drawing the specimen we saw, putting them under the microscope, understanding the evolutionary history of organisms through this herbarium collection. And it's not just herbarium collections that are in need of care and protection. I mean, there's entire collections of organisms too, and there's not just scientific purposes for these collections. I also want to throw out there that these collections are really important for culture and for art, for society. One of the curators at Green Bay is an artist, and he would always invite artists into the collections to use as inspiration, and they would have entire workshops where artists could come and go through the collections to look at organisms for inspiration, and there was like a whole gallery based on it too. So if you aren't convinced of the importance of collections and museums and herbaria and all of this, I don't know what else to tell you at this point. And I also wanted to bring up, too, on the topic of collections and protecting and preserving them, the lack of care for collection, the lack of care for parts of collections. And to explain this, I think it's best to describe what a type specimen is or a holotype. They're kind of used interchangeably sometimes. But a holotype is the single organism that a description of a new species is based on. And that single specimen is the foundation of how we define a particular species. And there are collections out there where holotypes are actively being destroyed because of lack of care. And I would also argue that this is due to a lack of funding, right? We don't have enough money to pay enough people to take care of these collections. And to be honest, you know, a lot of it is, like I said, it's because we don't have the manpower to run these collections. And even worse is when people do know that this is happening, that these holotypes are being destroyed or are decaying, and there's nothing being done about it, or people actively saying that they don't really care to do anything about it. And I really want to thank at Mossworm on Twitter/X for being vocal about this issue and their personal experience with collections, because this is not something unique to a single collection space. This happens across so many collections. And it's not, I guess it's not a situation to always point like a singular finger at someone, but the main message here is that we need more people to care, and we need more people, we need more funding, we need more awareness brought to these collections. And to kind of wrap this all up, I asked my friend Nina Sandlin, who works as a collections assistant, you know, what three things she wants people to know about collections and working in museums and how to support them. And here's what she said. Number one, even though museums often want a PhD or a PhD track person for the job, the work, knowledge, skill set, and even passions of a good collections manager are often different from those of a researcher. And I thought that was really powerful, and that gave me a lot to think about. Number two, for material and collections to inform researchers hundreds of years in the future, it needs regular maintenance and protection from all kinds of mishaps. So just like I talked about, we need people to be constantly maintaining these collections and making sure they're in good shape for the future. And number three, she mentioned, is increasingly important to know and become fluent in digital and cyber taxonomy tools, platforms and standards like TDWG, which I don't know what that is, and Darwin Core. But what Nina is saying here is there's a current movement to digitize a lot of collections so that we have them online and more accessible. And so I really like that she brought up too. So shout out to Nina. She works at the Field Museum, and I especially want to shout her out because I sent her that message at 3 a.m. and she kindly responded a few hours later. Brittany, what do you think of what Nina said?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Sorry, I was just like listening very intently to what you were saying, and I was just like furiously nodding my head along with all of it. Yeah. Nina's points are all very poignant. So following the announcement from Duke, I was just so distraught that I was really wondering, like, how many people even like know about collections outside of the scientific community? And I put up a couple polls on different social media sites, and I was just so struck by how many people not only knew, but so desperately wished that they could work there or continue having done their work there. There are so, so many people, some of which who might even be more knowledgeable about their fields than me without the proper even BS degree for it, that we could have, would be totally happy put to work in collections doing what other people might consider menial labor, such as like refilling ethanol, cataloging things. Because like the basis of a good collection is like, not only do you need lots of specimens, you have to know what you have and how much of it you have, so you can quickly communicate to researchers who might want to request a few specimens or like come and look at them. So yeah, we desperately need more people who not only care, but also work there. Even among the best institutions, even where I work, understaffing and underpaying people is a big problem. And the people who I do know who work in collections are so very, very passionate. It's just like they wish they could distribute their, they basically wish there were more of them to do the work that they have been set with, because like there is not, the things that they've been tasked to do, they could not complete within their own lifetimes, no matter how hard they tried or no matter how hard they loved these projects, which they already do so much. So that's like the big problem. We do need more people to care. And it seems like we at least do. It's just like, I just wish we could get them in here somehow, like whether through volunteering or, yes, properly paying people would be great. Yeah. And just, sorry, I'm like trying to think of like everything you were saying and trying to like respond to each thing. Yeah. With Duke, in specifically Duke. Yes. Not only is it a collection widely used by researchers all over the world, it is, I would think, first and foremost, a school collection, which means students get the opportunity to work there, as we might have stated before, and they might be inspired by working in there. I've already seen firsthand testimonies from many scientists on like Twitter who were like, my first experiences were working in an herbarium, and to think about closing one, especially the one where I worked at, because some of them actually did work at Duke Herbarium, are like, it feels like that beginning part of my career was just totally erased from this world. And I can't imagine like what I would feel if the collections I started working at were like just defunded and distributed everywhere else. And so we lose that possible source of inspiration and career spark for these young students to become the like our future's amazing researchers. And then to the part where they're like, you have 2 to 3 years to move 800,000 specimens. And it's like, ah, oh, they're just like tiny little bits of plants. That's probably fine, right? It really isn't. Because even when, at least in the entomological world, when we receive specimen loans, or not loans, when we receive donations of people's personal collections, which can get to be like hundreds and hundreds of wooden drawers, packing and moving them with just a few people is a totally arduous task. And it's like you need moving trucks and stuff. And it's like for that to happen to a bunch of plant specimens taped and glued very, very delicately to archival paper, some of which are like 100 years old, and types, they will inevitably get, like a large portion of them will inevitably get damaged, lost, and then data and things which are very important to specimens, that's the reason we have them. We need the data like collected about them, very properly associated them to them for that to be like of useful scientific research. That will inevitably get like lost along the way in these like multitude of moving trucks or however they're going to move it to all of these different institutions. So it's going to be much harder to coordinate all of these resources that have suddenly been fanned out across these different places. And furthermore, once they get to those institutions, it's going to be like, it's like a Herculean task to have to catalog those into their own collections and be like, okay, yes, we received this many whatevers from Duke University, and it's going to take forever to catalog them with the people who are probably, once again, understaffed and underpaid there to do all of that. And like, going back to the thing about Duke being a school collection is that a lot of their manpower comes from like students who are on like work study budgets. And you know, that as an undergraduate, even, you have no time to do anything outside of like homework and studying. So like, you know, they are not going to be able to properly help, even though they might really want to, with this like moving effort. And so it's just like, it's all around a bad situation, no matter how you look at it. It's just like crazy. Also, if I may put in like a very random point at this point in the conversation, I don't know why, but something you were talking about as you were reading like the AMNH's description of collections, it's triggered this thought in me, but in the Animal Crossing museums, you donate like a specimen once and that's it. Like you have like, oh, I found a new animal, time to donate it to Blathers. And you donate it once. And then like, that's the only representative that lives in that collection forever on exhibit. And that is absolutely not what happens at a museum. We probably were like implicative of this throughout our conversation here. But also, the Blathers' museum is honestly more of a zoo than it is a museum, because of all of everything there. Like 2/3 of the things in the biological exhibits are alive. It's pretty much just a zoo. But yes, for every species, you theoretically want to have a lot, like lots and lots and lots of representatives, because like I said before, the purpose of a collection is so you can have a really good spatial temporal record of this organism as a group through time and space. Like you want to know like how things changed over time, how their movements and places that they lived have changed over time, especially in accordance with how we might have changed the world within the past couple hundred years and whatnot. So yeah, that's just another thing. Like you just keep donating and collecting and giving those to museums so that we can improve our records for future researchers, like way, 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 way down the the line. So people might often see museum collections. I've had this on the polls that I put up be like, this is actually kind of horrifying. You just killed like a billion different animals to put them in your collection. Like, isn't one enough? Unfortunately, one and done is not how you do research. You might have heard people being like, you need a good sample size. And that's no exception for us. Like, mm-hmm. the myriad of uses that Jillian listed before, like not even just with climate change and other anthropogenic changes in our world today, there's like myriad different uses for the collections that we have, like phylogenetic research, seeing like the different evolutionary relationships between animals, how they came to be in this world, what they're doing between them and the environment, and how that's changing regardless of human impact or not. Like, it's just a good way for us to be curious about this world regardless of the impact that we put on it and regardless of the impact they might have on us. It's really just a way to fuel our own innate human curiosity about this world and how we can get along with it better, basically. So yeah. Sorry, I just, like, you were saying so many good points and I, like, didn't know where to interject, and so I, like, was quick to memorize everything and say it to the end.
That's totally, no, what you said was wonderful and I think really important additions to this conversation. And Brittany, as someone who works in a museum, if you had to, and you have to because I'm asking you to, what are the top three things you would want the average everyday person to know about museums and collections and how to support them? There are three things that you wanted people to know.
Three things about museums and collections. That's tough. Good question. I would say that a good collection is really big and really representative, which means that there are like a number you can't even imagine of how many specimens and how many species that they represent in there. God, I'm trying to find the good words to describe this. Yeah. So theoretically, yes, everything in a collection is supposed to be labeled and we're supposed to know what it is. But new things come out of collections themselves all the time. Things that we didn't know were there are often discovered. Things that we thought we knew what they were are actually not what they were. And so new species can be described that way. So, you never know what you're going to find in there. Every day working in there, I see something I've never seen before and could not have even possibly imagined. And my mind is just blown. It's just like, you cannot fathom the new things that you will be able to find in there, even just by working on like kind of menial secretarial things that I do there. So it's just like, really keep your mind open. And even when you keep your mind open, you'll see something you won't expect there. So that's the first thing, I suppose. The second thing is that, yes, collections are continually growing. I said this before like three times, but they are active things that are constantly growing and expanding. Collections managers and curators are often working together to see where the future directions of the collections will go, what they're going to be used for. And yeah, oftentimes those specimens might even be put on exhibit continually, like the project I worked on for preparing insects for the Gilder Center. Like, a lot of those specimens, the vast majority of them, in fact, came from our historical collections. Some of the insects I prepared were over 100 years old. It was crazy. But yeah, it sounds like museums hoard old stuff, but and yes, I guess we kind of do in a way, and it's for scientific purposes. But yes, the things we have are old, but the science that we conduct on them certainly is not history. We're continually doing it, and we're finding new things from those things every single day. And so, you'll find things in a collection that might be 200 years old or were collected and accessioned like yesterday. It's really fascinating to see the changes from specimens from in that period of time. And then what's a third thing that I would say about like...
Is there one piece of advice you would give to people in terms of supporting their local museum?
Supporting their local museum. I would say simply just going and donating, I suppose. Like, especially the local museums, like not even like the really big ones that we keep name dropping here. Like, if you have a local natural history museum or honestly even historical, whatever kind of museum near you, go and support them and really carefully take in everything you see around you, because no matter what museum you go to, I guarantee you when you look around, you'll always find something new. And I think that's basically what I just said for all three of my points. But yeah, what I think is really nice about life in general, not even just with science, is that no matter how hard you're looking at something, you're the same thing. Seemingly, you're always going to discover something new about life and another way to kind of put things into perspective. And so you can go contribute to museums' missions of helping people realize this and respecting the world they live in a bit more by visiting, donating, and asking if you can volunteer. I don't really have any experiences with local museums because I don't really have any where I live. But yeah, I'm sure the staff there would be happy to let people at least volunteer there. They're always looking for people to volunteer and help with explaining exhibits or maybe even helping with the collections behind the scenes. So, I mean, that's how I got my start in school. I was offered a volunteer position with our collections. So yeah, they're always looking for people. And especially if you go to a university and they have a collection there, I'm 99% sure they're looking for people to volunteer or work there. So always shoot your shot. That's how I got my start.
I would, you know, summarize most of this into just go visit your local museum. Go check it out. Talk to the people who work there and be curious. Ask questions about everything that you were seeing. Donate and volunteer if you are able. And museums are a great place to connect with your community and especially with the people who work there. So, Brittany, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. It's an honor to be your friend. I'm so glad we got to finally meet in January. Yeah. And, you know, before we go, what plugs do you have and where can people find you? Do you want people to find you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, the one plug I would have is probably just my main science Twitter, N2Enthusiast. That's all. So you can find me on Twitter if you want.
How do you spell that?
ENTO, ENTHUSIAST. I hope I spelled that right. But yeah, I guess you could also put it in the description if you want.
And as always, listeners, you can join me and the Pika Science crew on Discord using the link below in the episode description. And finally, if you want to follow me, Jillian, on my socials, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky as Bugs or Bust. That is BUGSORBUST. Thank you all for tuning in and leveling up with EXP.